Welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Hosted by Beth Burschak, with expert advice from Jim Lang, Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney and retirement and estate planning expert. Jim is also the author of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. To find out more about his book, his practice, Lang Financial Group, and how to secure Jim as a speaker for your next event, visit his website at retiresecure.com. Now, get ready to talk smart money.
Thank you for joining us this evening. We are talking smart money. I'm Beth Burschak, along with Jim Lang, CPA, attorney, author of two best-selling editions of the book, Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. And our guest in the studio tonight, Blaine Aiken, who is president and CEO of Bridgeville-based Fiduciary 360. Blaine, thank you so much for joining us in studio tonight. Blaine is also the author of the monthly Fiduciary Corner column in Investment News magazine. We're going to be getting to, a little bit later on in the hour, some of the recent scandals, some of the recent financial scandals that have happened, what happened, how it happened, how you can avoid having it happen to you. Before we do that, Blaine, can you explain exactly what Fiduciary 360 does?
Sure. And thank you very much for having me here this evening. We're an organization whose mission is to promote a culture of fiduciary responsibility and help those who manage money on behalf of others improve their decision-making overall.
And so who comes under that umbrella? Who exactly is a fiduciary?
Right. A fiduciary is basically anyone who manages money on behalf of others and therefore stands in a special relationship of trust or legal or ethical responsibility. And there's basically three categories. You could say there's the investment steward, and that's typically somebody like a plan sponsor for a retirement program or an investment committee member or a trustee. The second category is an investment advisor, somebody who is engaged to provide comprehensive and continuous advice. And then the third category would be an investment manager who actually makes the buy and sell decisions for security selection.
And as we speak, all of these groups come under different levels of responsibility.
They do.
So can you go through some of those levels of responsibility for this? Because I think that the average investor really doesn't even realize that.
And actually, before you do that, if you can even just go one step more basic, can you even just say what a fiduciary is in case somebody says, well, what the heck is a fiduciary?
Right.
And just explain the special relationship and the obligation of a fiduciary.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. A fiduciary is anyone who is given the responsibility to manage money. And so they are working in a position, a relationship of trust. And the very nature of that trust relationship establishes certain obligations. And there's really five that are probably most noteworthy in your obligations. The first is that a fiduciary has a singular duty of loyalty. So in other words, they must place the investor's best interest first. And I'll contrast that, too, with others, if you like.
All right. And by the way, that would also be consistent with other fiduciaries that might not be investing money, per se. For
That's
example,
right.
an executor of an estate or even a trustee of a trust who isn't perhaps investing money directly, but they have an obligation to fulfill the terms of the will, for example.
Right.
Or to follow the terms of the trust.
Right.
And now what you're just saying is we're going to take it one step further and say let's look specifically for people who are investing money for others.
That's right. At Fiduciary 360, we concentrate on the investment fiduciary and provide the training and web-based tools and ongoing support for those folks. But you're absolutely right. You can think of a fiduciary in the same context you would the classic professions, like a CPA or an attorney or a doctor.
Oh, so Jim would be falling under that category.
Absolutely, right. That's right. As a CPA and as an attorney, you would have those fiduciary responsibilities as well.
Which basically means that, let's just say, forgetting about investing money, let's say giving tax advice or giving estate planning advice, that I have to keep the client's best interests in mind
right.
for any advice that I might give. Now, we'll get to the investments in a minute. I just want to be more basic and just make it clear to people that, and I think that people actually kind of expect that if you go to a CPA and you pay them X dollars an hour, that you can expect the advice that you're going to get is going to be geared towards what will be best for you not what will be best for the CPA.
Right.
And the same thing going to a lawyer. A lawyer has both a moral as well as a legal and professional obligation to say what is best for the client and not what is best for the lawyer.
Right.
All right. I just wanted to be very basic. And then what your organization is apparently most involved in is a fiduciary obligation of somebody who actually manages money.
Right. That's okay. Exactly right. We term that an investment fiduciary to try and specify further that we're concentrating on that aspect. But that singular duty of loyalty is really the central duty that we talk about. There are other aspects of this due care, which is essentially a higher obligation to be a prudent expert. So you have a higher level of knowledge and skill and judgment than what you might in other standards, and you have an obligation to make full and fair disclosure, as well as avoiding conflicts of interest. Those are other major categories of duties.
I want to give the phone number, too, just in case anybody has a question in the next hour. 412-333-9385 if you'd like to toss out a question here to Blaine Aiken, President CEO of Fiduciary 360. 412-333-9385. Now, can we go through what you're talking about, the investment category? Why mm-hmm. are there different levels of responsibility
right.
for some of these different investment groups?
Well, classically, there have been two categories. One would be the traditional broker, who is more involved on the transactional side. So if you know that you want to buy a security, a shares in IBM or whatever the case may be, you may go to a classic broker. And in that sense, those individuals are subject to what's known as the suitability standard, where they have an obligation to know some fundamental facts about you and be involve fair dealing with just like any other type of a commercial transaction. Well, that's contrasted with somebody who you are going to for a relationship of advice. And a relationship advice goes more to the same concept of the CPA and the attorney, where the expectation is it's not a focus on the transaction, it's a focus on the quality of the advisor and the relationship that's likely to be established. So there's a very different standard of obligations.
But aren't there a lot of stockbrokers out there who are, in effect, the principal financial advisor for clients? And I would imagine, either whether they have a legal fiduciary duty or not, that I would at least hope that at least some of them would do what is in the best interest of the client. So, for example, not churn accounts, have a well-diversified portfolio, do some things that perhaps somebody that is held to a higher legal standard.
Right. In many instances, the broker-dealer community, we have individuals who have a high ethical standard, and they follow many of the same principles that a fiduciary would. But in reality, the regulatory structure is very different. So if you go back to the differential, those that are on the brokerage side or the suitability side of the equation, they're actually governed in this instance of investments by FINRA, which used to be the NASD. So it's a self-regulatory organization. It's very much commercial transaction, fair dealing oriented. Those who are investment advisors are regulated by the SEC under those principles of fiduciary responsibility. On the suitability side, we have, for example, the big distinction is it's not a singular duty of loyalty, but you're able to have multiple loyalties, and among those being to your company. So you have an obligation to produce in a sales capacity on behalf of the company.
Well, let's say you're part of a big brokerage company, and the big brokerage company just bought 1 million shares of XYZ stock, and they obviously want to peddle it, and they might encourage some of their brokers to say, hey, go out and peddle this. In fact, if you do, we'll give you some extra compensation.
Right. And that's permissible under the rules of the commercial standard, under the suitability standard today. Now, you pointed out the fact that things have evolved over time, and originally there was an exemption for incidental advice given by those on the broker-dealer side of the world. And usually what that meant was that you could say things like, I would prefer Dell versus IBM. So it's transactionally oriented. Well, as time has gone on, there's a lot more advice being given. And a big part of regulatory reform right now is to extend that fiduciary status over onto the side of anyone who gives advice, any level of advice.
Well, one of the problems that I have, and I do training to different financial advisors all over the country, and most of my training is IRA and retirement plan and specifically Roth IRA training, and it's not necessarily investment advice, but it's more tax strategies. And then a lot of them come back and say, well, the problem is I'm not allowed to give tax advice.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have an answer for them, because to me, I don't know how you could be an advisor and not give somebody tax advice.
Well, and that's the dilemma. I mean, when you are working with someone, if you are an individual investor or someone who's offering a pension program, by and large, you're seeking advice. And those who are providing services, investment services, whether they're a broker or whether they're an advisor, are inclined to give that advice because there isn't the same volume of transactional activity that there once was. And certainly there's between online trading and discount brokerage, where it's purely transactional, that's not as much the norm anymore with a lot of the full-service brokerage.
Well, one of the things that gets me, let's talk about the pension fiduciary obligation mm-hmm. of somebody who is managing a retirement plan, for example. Most of the retirement plans in this country do not offer a Roth 401k, or in the nonprofit world, a Roth 403b. And I'm thinking, why not? This is a great opportunity for people to put in $22,500 of money that can grow income tax-free. How can the person who is offering these investments as a service and is making money when you make a contribution to your retirement plan not proactively saying, hey, you should really consider a Roth 401k, not just a traditional 401k? And to me, I almost think that they should have a fiduciary duty to do what is in the best interest of their client.
They do have a fiduciary duty to do what's in the best interest of their client. Now, the question is, how far does that duty extend into the more sophisticated strategies? But you're absolutely right. The plan sponsor is under the obligation to look at the participant pool that they're serving and determine what is the right structure and what's the right composition of the investments of the portfolio that they're offering.
Well, even just on this limited issue of Roth 401k versus traditional 401k,
mm-hmm.
and let's assume that the group is at least 10 people.
Yes.
There almost inevitably is going to be at least one or two, maybe eight or nine people that a Roth 401k is more appropriate than a traditional 401k. I can't understand why people aren't given this choice routinely, and why only some companies are offering Roth 401ks. Even some of the larger companies have not caught on yet.
When you go to someone and you are seeking advice in an investment capacity, that you have the right to a fiduciary level of care. And what that essentially means is that advisor must place your best interests first. So you can't have the divided interests. The decisions that have to be made have to be done exclusively in the interest of the client. That's critical.
So that sounds like the traditional stockbroker or insurance agent would be held to a higher level than they are right now.
That's the intent. And the big question in our minds is to whether, let me throw out a term there for you. But there's a lot of talk about harmonization of the two regulatory structures, that suitability standard versus the fiduciary standard. And it makes good sense to harmonize. When we talk about the scandals, we'll see some of the impacts of being in disharmony, if you will. But the idea is to harmonize those standards. Well, what we want to see happen is that we lift the standard, as you described it, to the fiduciary level, rather than try and find some middle ground that at the same time disadvantages those who are getting fiduciary level of care today, even as it raises the standard on the other side. So I think it's a critical thing to watch.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, it's easy for me as a highbrow CPA, attorney, and registered investment advisor who is held to both a legal and moral high ground, if you will,
mm-hmm.
to say, oh, yes, everybody should be at that same fiduciary duty, which frankly would help my business. But aren't the stockbrokers and insurance people going to scream bloody murder if all of a sudden they have to have their primary loyalty to the client and not split? And if they have to, and I would imagine disclosure is also a big item here.
It is big, but there's, you referenced the fact earlier that there's a lot of stockbrokers that are out there today doing a high-quality ethical job, and I think that's absolutely true. And so those folks, I think they're going to be on the front line of cheerleaders for change, because right now they're caught in a very difficult situation. They're operating to a fiduciary ethic in a suitability world, that which exists over on the broker-dealer side. And that's a very difficult role to play when whenever you have your regulatory structure out of sync with what your behavior is. And then there's other stockbrokers who don't want to give advice. They are just assisting transactions. And those folks are rightly on the suitability side. There's no reason to raise the standard there to a fiduciary level if all the investor is seeking is transactional assistance.
But realistically, I can't imagine going to a financial advisor and not wanting to know certain things like asset allocation, Roth IRA conversion advice. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, one of my concerns would be, and I know that there's ethical stockbrokers who do the right thing, mm-hmm. but just by the nature of the way they get paid, mm-hmm. which is they get paid when somebody buys or sells a stock, to me is really not in harmony with the client's best interest, which would be a fee to look at the big picture and provide ongoing advice.
You're right. And again, if it's in the instance of advice, then I think that really a fee basis for the relationship, level compensation where there aren't the conflicts of interest of being incentivized to recommend one thing over another, that's where we have to go. And that's what the fiduciary standard requires.
And so do you think that fee structure would change if some of these proposals actually happen?
I think it's going to make a huge difference, because not only will investors better understand that whenever they go to somebody for advice, they can be sure that that the person that they're talking to is accountable to a fiduciary level. But if that fiduciary requirement is extended across the board, products have to change. Because essentially today on the suitability side of the world, whenever you design a product for the sales distribution side, then you look at how much does it pay. And so consequently, you are building in products that have commission structure, that have non-level compensation. All that's going to have to change.
It actually sounds like a major upheaval.
It does. It will be, because it will spill down to the design of products. I think it will drive down costs. It will make the overall awareness higher of investment advice as being more professional at its core, much like the CPA, attorney, so forth.
What do you think would be the end result, the main difference? Let's just say you're listening to the show tonight, you're just the average investor.
Right.
What would it mean to you if those changes actually happened?
In all likelihood, a couple of things are going to happen. You're going to have greater accessibility of advisors who are held to that standard of care. It will drive down the price of a lot of the investment products, because what will happen is that the internal expenses that go to fund commissions and to an extra what they call revenue sharing, those things will have to come out of the picture, because in that case, we're going to have investments compete on their investment merits, and then the advisors are paid on a fee basis overall. So you're going to see some big changes.
Well, as I understand it, a lot of these financial products have commissions of 10% or even higher.
They can, yeah.
And boy, I kind of wish I sold those, because that's a real one. But by the way, I'm licensed to sell them. I'm licensed to sell life insurance. And in Pennsylvania, if you're licensed to sell life insurance, you're licensed to sell some of these annuity products. And I've never sold one to anyone because I just don't think it is appropriate. But it seems to me that if right now you're making a living selling these relatively high commission type products and the legislation that you're talking about passes, that you're going to have to change the way you do business. And then some of these products that are cloaked, and I talk to people who buy these products very, very frequently, and they can't tell me how the advisor is paid. Mm-hmm. They just say, well, the advisor is paid by the company, and I'm not paying the advisor. Well, what do you mean it's paid by the company? The company's paying the advisor to be nice and the advisor is giving you the best advice that he knows when the reality is he's making a 10% commission on what he's selling you. So I actually think that there might be some profound differences.
I agree with you. There's definitely going to be some very significant changes overall. The insurance side of the equation is still very much up in question. Most of the concentration of conversation is on the investment side, but the same. You're absolutely right. The same issues arise on the insurance side.
On some of the simple insurance type policies, and those are the ones that I tend to favor, things like term life or even guaranteed universal life, I think that they're relatively straightforward products, and I think that the commissions are more or less level or even. Are you talking about some of the more, let's say, harder to understand type products, like even just like a whole life policy or policies that have different bells and whistles in them?
Yes. I mean, the insurance products generally are today handled on a commission basis. If fiduciary responsibility is extended across the board, then I think you'll see more and more what they call no-load insurance products, where the commission is brought out of the product and rather it's handled on a fee basis, much like investment side.
And Blaine and Jim, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, too, we want to talk about some of the recent scandals.
Yes.
What happened? What went wrong, how you can keep it from happening to you in the future. It is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Talking smart money, and thank you for joining us this evening. I'm Beth Bershock, along with Jim Lang, and Blaine Aiken is our guest tonight, president and CEO of Bridgeville-based Fiduciary 360. Busy summer because so many things have happened after the big financial scandals. And if you have a question in this next half an hour, feel free to call at 412-333-9385. Blaine, the main question is, and the number one guy when you say financial scandal, Bernie Madoff is the first person that pops into your mind, even though there have been many since then.
There have, unfortunately.
Unfortunately. But the main question is always, how did he get away with that for so long?
Right.
And how did he get away with that?
Well, there's a lot of angles to that question, but fundamentally, I mean, first of all, he was a crook. He was a smart, arrogant individual who commanded a certain air of responsibility, and so people tended to trust him. And unfortunately, I think among those who are most trusting are the most ethical people. So the most ethical people are the most vulnerable to people who have no ethics. So consequently, for example, he focused a lot of his attention on charities and foundations and endowments, and he duped a lot of people. And there were regulatory failures. In this case, the SEC is well known that back in 2005, a gentleman by the name of Harry Markopoulos sent a letter to the SEC, basically laid out what had transpired, what he believed to be transpiring with Mr. Madoff. And due to the questions about who had jurisdiction and due to gross understaffing and frankly, a level of incompetence that it slipped through the crack.
Do you think that that's going to change at the SEC? Because right now, most people are going, what were they doing for the past decade?
Yes, I think it is going to change in two respects. One is that the financial crisis overall has demonstrated the weaknesses in the regulatory system. So I think we're going to see much greater role clarity, and I think the SEC is going to end up with more responsibility but far more resources. They are just way understaffed.
You know, and just in case anybody is unclear exactly what happened with the Madoff situation, which was a Ponzi scheme, explain exactly how it was working.
Well, yes, his was the most simple of all scandals, if you will. He did it in a way that he took people's money and basically stuck it in his pocket. It was not elaborate in a lot of ways. He was just able to accomplish that. And one of the big ways he was able to accomplish it is he was wearing multiple hats. He served in a capacity of being the advisor to these folks. He also was what's known as the executing broker, so he made the trades. He was the money manager, and he was the custodian. Well, in a day and age where you can do almost anything with a personal computer. He essentially manufactured records. He would be able to take the money in, never actually deposit it, but create records that were fictional.
And so I was going to ask that. Is that what was happening? People were getting fictional accounts of their...
That's right. They were getting fictional accounts, and that was the major way that this was perpetrated. Now, I mentioned on the regulatory breakdowns, but there were fiduciary breakdowns. The people who invested with Mr. Madoff had fiduciary responsibility to do due diligence, and a lot of that wasn't done.
So, in other words, there were money managers who would place their clients' money with Bernie Madoff, and what you're saying is they should have actually checked out his operation. They should have. They probably were duped in good faith themselves. It wasn't like they were terrible people,
right.
But they didn't fulfill their obligation of checking on him and saying, well, how the heck does the guy make 10% every year in every market?
Right.
Please explain to me your strategy, Bernie. Where does it say that in your prospectus?
You must ask the difficult questions, because a fiduciary's obligation, if you manage money for other people, you have absolute obligation to do so in a responsible way, and that means asking the tough questions. And if you'd ask enough of the tough questions, you wouldn't have ended up invested there.
And I know myself, because I am in a fiduciary capacity, and I do recommend money managers to clients, and I am compensated for it. I personally, and this is just my own bias as a CPA, I like to see certified statements by a CPA. Yes, this is what this is the internal controls that this company has. Yes, this company really did get do this performance level during these years.
That's
and
right.
We certify that. And when companies say, well, gee, I didn't want to pay the CPA, or gee, we don't really keep those kind of records, then I lose interest in doing business with that kind of company.
And so for you, that would be a red flag immediately.
Yeah, and it's not even necessarily a red flag. There are companies who don't want to pay a CPA firm to audit their statement. To me, I think that that's just part of the cost of doing business. And if I'm going to tell a client, here, I think that you should, you know, let this particular money manager manage $500,000 or $1 million or whatever it might be, I think the least that person should do is, and we're doing that in part based on a historical performance, I want to know that those historical numbers that are given to the client are not made up, and that there is a CPA firm that's in the yellow pages that you can find.
It's not in the Cayman Islands somewhere.
That's, by the way, that's very important, and you can actually look at the, in effect, the disciplinary history of that CPA firm, and to me that is just due diligence, and apparently that isn't what happened with a lot of Bernie Madoff's money managers.
You're right, and that specifically is one of the common threads in a lot of these scandals, that if you ask that key question, and this is a very good point, because you're seeking third-party verification of critical information, and the financial reports are key pieces of information. In Mr. Madoff's case, he was using essentially a two-man accounting shop that didn't even list auditing as one of its responsibilities. In the Stanford case, they actually were Cayman-based auditors, I believe. They were,
really?
Yes, they were Caribbean island-based
there
auditors.
There you go. That.
So those are the types of things that come up. And likewise, with performance reports, there's what's known as the GIPS standards. These are global investment performance standards, and it's using a third party to evaluate whether, in fact, that performance really happened or not. And whenever people would talk to Mr. Madoff, he would dismiss individuals who ask difficult questions and say, either I don't have time for that, or you're not, you have no right of asking me in my position of authority. And people let him get away with that. And if anybody treats you that way, you have to walk away.
And could you expound on the idea of the separation between holding the money and advising people,
right,
regarding which stocks and bonds and appropriate investments would be in the client's best interest.
Right. There are checks and balances that are naturally built into a system. And so typically what you're going to want is to have the party that's holding the assets actually has physical possession or custody. That's typically a bank or a brokerage firm or some recognizable name of a financial institution. And that's
like Charles Schwab, for example.
Charles Schwab would be a good example, Bank of New York, something like that in terms of those who would serve in a custody capacity. And they issue your monthly statements. Now, if you look at your monthly statements that you receive, that's where you can really go through and see what's happening. You see what transactions were taking place and all of that. And so that's everybody, as a piece of advice, should be looking at those custodial statements and making sure that it's reflective of the reality you believe there to be. Now, in the case of Bernie Madoff, he made it up. So the statements looked okay.
Oh, they actually did look okay.
They looked okay because he created them. But here's where another piece of this would come into play. If one of the things that Harry Markopoulos, the fellow who wrote to the SEC and discovered the problem, he went back and started to check the actual strategy and said, are these the prices at that point in time for these strategies? And they were not the accurate prices. And he looked at the strategies as much as Mr. Madoff would declare and said, this is not feasible. This could not have happened. In fact, there were more volume just in Mr. Madoff's clients than existed at the time, just from what he was reporting. So there were real discrepancies. Now, and this is why we would strongly recommend that you ask whoever you're dealing with, your service providers, and you say, explain to me where the money is held, what your relationship to that party is, and try and make sure that there's independence across these various roles. Because anytime someone is doing all the jobs, that's a formula for abuse.
You know, the way you described it, that he was manufacturing all of these false statements,
right.
It sounds almost impossible for one guy to do by himself.
I think you're exactly right. I think it's beyond comprehension that it was just Mr. Madoff.
Now, and yet he's the only one taking the fall right now.
He is the major one taking the fall. There's more under investigation, more who have taken the fall to a certain extent. But I don't think there's any way in the world that everyone who has been responsible has actually been held accountable.
Now, if we could, here's another on your list of things to avoid, and I cannot believe that anyone actually does this, mm-hmm. but you were just touching on this, that advisors should never take custody of a client's assets. When you are the end consumer and you're writing the check, mm-hmm. should it not be going to the people that are holding the money and not your advisor?
Yes, that's right.
That would be a sign to me if my advisor said, Beth, just write that check out to me.
Right.
I'd be a little concerned.
You should be. That should not happen.
So the check should be made out to Charles Schwab, for example.
That's right.
Not the advisor. To be specific, Lang Financial Group.
Right. That's right. And what's happening
to
now...
To be specific. Yeah, let's toss that out there.
I'll just throw that out there.
No, but there are some changes along the way, too, that today an advisor is allowed to have custody, but there are certain rules wrapped around that. Going forward, I think you're either going to see that disallowed or that the proposal is to have those firms audited on a
daily.
On an unannounced basis.
It was something this is an old, old adage, but I think in particular in the Bernie case, this is absolutely true. Blaine, you say if something seems too good to be true, it probably is.
Right.
If you are sitting on 10% return and then a 12% return and then a 13% return year after year after year, you have to be thinking in the back of your mind, how could this be happening?
Right. The markets are very efficient overall, which is not to say that some measure of outperformance, I think, is possible. But that's extraordinarily rare. And it's almost unheard of to be able to do that with great consistency.
And particularly to beat it by so many points.
That's right.
You know, if the market has, say, averaged 8, and you found a firm that might average 9 or even 9.5, That's a great performance, but if you get somebody who's averaging 14,
There's either
then maybe something's up.
Something is up, or they're taking extraordinary risk. And if they're taking extraordinary risk, you could hit home runs, but you stand a good chance of striking out and worse.
Blaine, something that we do at our office and something that Jim is absolutely huge on is educating.
Right.
And educating, he educates his own clients constantly.
Right.
We hold seminars. We have one actually coming up on October 24th. It's about the Roth tax law change in 2010. But even in the office, Jim is constantly educating people. And do you think that's also an important part of not getting burned by advisors?
It is critical. I mean, whenever you have so much riding on the future of your finances, that you have to have at least a level of understanding to know to be able to recognize whenever something just is not feasible or doesn't sound right, or that you are at least getting a logical explanation of what's being recommended to you. And I think that's why you have to both be a little bit skeptical and you have to be inquisitive to learn a little bit more about your investments.
And if you think something is a little fishy,
yes,
how would you investigate that? I mean, let's say you're my advisor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm beginning to think something is not right.
Right.
What should I do?
Well, there's several things you can do. I mean, certainly you can do background checks with the regulatory authorities. And one of the things that's happening on the advisor front is that there is a disclosure document that is required of advisors called the ADV form. And that provides a great deal of information. You actually should read those disclosures. It's amazing that sometimes you'll have people say, yes, I got that document, but I didn't read it. And if you actually read the document, it has in there a list as long as your arm of regulatory violations. You can also go back and check.
Unless you don't have regulatory violations.
That's right.
Those are the kind of advisors that you want to go to.
Right. Absolutely. And that's the norm. The norm is that there are not a lot of regulatory violations, but if there are, that's where they show up.
Because most of the people haven't been caught yet.
But it could be.
Because the SEC is so understaffed.
But and the professional organizations, too. If you have an advisor who is a CPA, is an attorney, is someone who holds, for example, one of our designations, the accredited investment fiduciary or accredited investment fiduciary analyst, you can go to those sponsoring organizations and find out their status. So, for example, with the AIF, our accredited investment fiduciary designation, that's recognized by FINRA. Well, if you go to our homepage, you can actually click on the icon there to find out who is a member in good standing as an accredited investment fiduciary. And I'm sure the same thing is true with the respect to going to the AICPA, for example, or the bar.
So almost as an investor, you need to do a little bit of due diligence yourself.
Particularly, I think you certainly want to get resume information. You want to interview those. I mean, it's essentially, the way you usually find a good advisor is much the same way as you find a good contractor. You're typically going to interview a few people and find out, you have your list of services that you're looking for. You interview people, find out what they are specializing in, what they charge, what their references are, and so forth. And so you should do the same thing on the investment side.
Here's another little piece that I think this helps, and this helped in the Bernie case.
Right.
It helped him to scam people. But there have been a couple of local cases, too, where the key issue was that you went there on recommendation,
right,
of somebody. So you're my relative, and you say to me, this guy is the best.
Right.
You have to see him. He's been getting me great returns, and you do no homework.
Right.
You just hand over your money because somebody else said you should do it. And that's what happened. But there have been some local cases where that has happened.
That's right. And I think there's a couple things that we can say. Number one is it's good to get recommendations, but then ask the person providing the recommendation, how did you go about selecting them and what makes you confident that they are good? Because half the time you find out, oh, he's just the nicest person.
Or
he serves on the...
He's a great guy. Of course he's a great guy.
And boy, can he golf. You know? It's those sorts of things where it comes up. Or in Mr. Madoff's case, I mean, he was active in the charities. So here the recommendations came because, oh, he's so committed to our cause.
He gives us a lot of money.
That's right. But in reality, that's not those recommendations you can largely disregard because good people aren't necessarily good. You know, the people that you perceive as being good aren't necessarily good. You want to go back and be able to explore in detail what is their specialty? What is their record? Have they published? Are they do they have the advanced education? And those things you can check as well.
And I think that, earlier you had mentioned third-party endorsement, if you will, and now you're saying have the people written articles and preferably are the articles peer-reviewed.
That's right.
All right, and does the person have an audited, or the investment company have an audited statement of saying, well, here's our historical record in the past.
Right.
And here is, let's say, for example, the benchmarks.
Right.
And here our auditors are willing to put it on the line that, yes, we are equal or even better than the benchmarks. I actually think that is something that is fair for people to ask.
Absolutely. I mean, take for example in your book, I mean, you demonstrate the level of knowledge that you have, and you have the testimonials there that are meaningful with respect to the specifics of the techniques you're talking about. And I think that is the type of thing that builds assurance. What I'm saying is you have to be careful of the recommendation that really is not central to the matter at hand.
And I don't want to mention names, and actually one of the gentlemen is actually on talk radio. And he says no, Roth IRAs are no good, and that Roth IRA conversions are no good. And then he cites a book of somebody who says that retirement plans and 401ks are no good.
Right.
Now this is a popular guy, and I'm thinking, oh my God, he's just giving this information out on the radio, and then when people see him in person and they ask for recommendations, people that in my mind are perfect candidates for Roth IRA conversions, he's saying, oh no. And then he cites somebody who has written books saying that 401k plans and retirement plans are no good. Instead, you should buy all these insurance products that, frankly, I am not a big fan of.
Right.
So
It does come down to the test of collecting the information, doing the review, look at what makes sense, and then even check with others. And I think that third-party verification idea is still a good one across the board.
And Blaine and Jim, we are going to take a quick break here. We are talking smart money. It's the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Thank you for joining us this evening, talking smart money with Jim Lang and Blaine Aiken, our guest tonight, president and CEO of Bridgeville-based Fiduciary 360. We were talking about education just a few minutes ago, and Jim is huge on education, which is one of the reasons you wrote your books, Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. Some great information in those books, which, by the way, there's a link on our website, retiresecure.com, if you're interested in that. But we do have two fall seminars coming up, and I want to point out the dates. One is October 14th, and that's going to be at the Holiday Inn, Mossside Boulevard in Monroeville. And then we're also going to have one on November 21st. We're going to be at the Four Points by Sheraton in Mars. In either case, you can call 1-800-748-1571 to RSVP, 1-800-748-1571. The topic is getting really, really hot. It's about the tax law change coming January 1st, which is a tax law change involving Roth IRAs, and we're going to be covering that in detail in these workshops. So you can get more, too, by going to our website, which is retiresecure.com. Now, Blaine, you have a big, big week. Well, it's Friday. You're going to be in Washington, D.C. You're going to be in front of the SEC, and can you explain what you're going to be doing?
Yes, we have the opportunity to speak with the SEC Chairman, Mary Shapiro, and we'll be providing some suggestions regarding regulatory reform. I've been fortunate to be a part of a group called the Committee for the Fiduciary Standard, and it was a group of individuals who are active in the financial services arena who believe strongly in extending the fiduciary standard to all those who provide advice. And so what we do is specifically promote those five core principles that I mentioned to you, the duty of loyalty and full and fair disclosure and avoidance of conflicts of interest. So we will have the opportunity to meet with the SEC Chairman Shapiro had a chance to meet with a couple of the other commissioners, and we do want to express to them what we believe why these issues are so important.
Now, what if you're sitting here in Pittsburgh and you really want to make your voice heard?
Yes.
And no matter what side of the argument you're coming down on, how would you do that?
There's a couple things that you can do. One, if you would choose to become a part of the Committee for the Fiduciary Standard, you can do so. This is an open organization of anyone who feels compelled to make their voice heard. And there is also a petition that can be signed. And the way people can get involved in that, one of the ways is to go to our website, and it'll take you to some links.
But and your website is?
It's fi360.com, so fi360.com. And there's a section called Resources and Advocacy, and it describes the committee and the petition, so people could go there and express their support.
So let's say you're a listener and you say, yes, I want financial advisors to be held to a higher standard of fiduciary duty.
Right.
They could go to
www.fi360.com.
Fi360.com, and then what should they specifically be looking for?
There's a tab there. Our services are training, tools, and resources. And in there's a tab called Resources, and that's where we provide a lot of information about fiduciary responsibility overall. So there's articles and all of that. But under Resources, there's an area called Advocacy. And if you click on Advocacy, it'll take you to information about the committee. And from there, it's pretty self-explanatory.
And have you noticed over the summer, since all of this has happened and proposals have been in front of Congress, has it really picked up?
Oh, it has. A great deal of interest in this area, and people are becoming much more informed. And the other thing you can do is contact your legislators and express your support. There is a particular SEC commissioner who, in my view, is absolutely superb. It's a gentleman by the name of Luis Aguilar. And the Commissioner Aguilar is very articulate on the subject of fiduciary responsibility. So anyone who would go to the SEC website, for example, sec.gov, you can look up the commissioners and write Commissioner Aguilar and give him great support, because there's some strong moneyed interests that are in opposition
to
this.
Well, sure. Yeah. In fact, there has to be huge opposition on the other side, because it's really going to be a major upheaval in the industry. And it seems like it's going to be so major that I can't believe this would be happening in the next week or the next month. Or how long do you really think changes will take place? It'll take.
Well, today, as you know, healthcare is the front and center.
Sure.
And so it's difficult to push the financial services back to the front. But everything we're hearing is that work is going to continue on the financial services side. And I think if we're lucky, we'll see action by the end of the year.
Do you really?
I think it's possible. And that would be a big boost. The thing to watch out for is, as I mentioned early in the show, that there will be attempts to redefine what fiduciary means. Fiduciary is very well defined in law. It's a long existing standard. It goes back actually to the Middle Ages in English common law, and it's been further developed, fully developed under retirement plan law here in the United States. So that's the standard we want to see retained. Now, fortunately, even the industry lobby groups recognize that it's hard to argue against putting the investor's best interest first. So there's a lot of vocalization from within the industry to say, yeah, what we need is a fiduciary standard. But it's not a fiduciary standard we need. It's the fiduciary standard, the one that's well-defined in law.
All right, so you are headed to Washington, D.C., and if anybody wants to check out your website, it's www.fi360.com. Any last quick tips for just the average investor?
Well, I think, again, it's do your homework, be skeptical, and yet take responsibility for truly doing your homework.
Takes a little bit of work.
It takes work. The other thing I would say is ask your advisor if they do, in fact, adhere to a fiduciary standard, because they are required to tell
you.
Jim,
has anybody ever asked you that? Have they ever come into the office and actually said that?
I don't think they have. I sometimes think that I bring that up. In fact, one of my advisors tells me that I should bring that up on a regular basis and tell people I am held to a fiduciary standard, which means I have to represent your best interest both. And see, this is a little bit unusual, because I am a CPA and an attorney, and they each have their own fiduciary standards that, and I'm different from a lot of the advisors because I am from the fee world where you work a certain amount of time or provide a certain service and you get a fee for it, and was not brought up in the, if I sell you, I make money, if I don't sell you, I don't make money.
Which is entirely different.
Yeah.
Well, Blaine, thank you so much for joining us. It has been wonderful information tonight. I do want to point out that the rebroadcast is going to be this Sunday. It's going to be 9 to 10 in the morning, and then it will be posted on our website, retiresecure.com, within a week or so. And again, Blaine's website is www.fi360.com. And again, our website, retiresecure.com, will give you information on our upcoming workshops. We have one October 24th and one on November 21st. And we've been talking so much about education and just getting everything all in one package. And Jim is going to make an offer here for a free financial physical. And Jim, explain what's involved, because people will call me and say, what happens when I come in? What will be happening if somebody calls the office and they come in for a free financial physical?
Well, I always like to ask people for a list of assets and a tax return. And I prefer to get that actually ahead of time. And based on that information, I will develop a list of things that I want to talk about and perhaps improvements that can be made. But the way I always start meetings is say, what is your biggest concern?
Because for everybody, it's different.
It is different. And I have, you know, things, you know, you would think, well, providing for myself and providing for my wife and or providing for my husband or providing for my kids or reducing taxes. And to me, I just kind of take that as second nature. But, you know, one person said, my biggest concern is my no-good son-in-law gets one red cent of my money.
Sometimes that's a huge concern.
We had to address that issue before we got to taxes or the spouse or anything else.
And so, if that's an issue, we can address that. So let me give the phone number. It's 412-521-2732. This is going to be a free financial physical, which normally takes about an hour. 412-521-2732. Jim will address everything. Investments, your insurance needs, Roth analysis. My extension is 219, so if you call that number tonight and you dial my extension, I will be giving you a call back tomorrow. 412-521-2732. We will be back in 2 weeks with Jonathan Clements, one of your favorites who used to write for the Wall Street Journal. Get more at retiresecure.com, and it is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Portions of the audio that you just heard will be posted online at retiresecure.com. You can also find a list of upcoming events and topics at retiresecure.com. To seek Jim's advice personally or to speak to a member of his dedicated staff at Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, call 412-521-2732. Join us again in 2 weeks when we talk more smart money.